listener production.
Okay, are you recording?
Hi guys, you are listening to episode 77 of the Howie Games. Part A off the top, thanks to all you cool cats for tuning in. And if anyone out there has recommended the show to someone this week, the Howie Games salute you. It is outstanding, truly, because it allows the show to continue to grow, which in turn means we can keep rolling out more episodes. This week's ep, it is the perfect example of all the good stuff in life. Going out on a limb, having a crack, defying the odds. It features a fantastic fellow by the name of Phil Anderson. Phil is a trailblazer in Australian cycling, the very first non-European to wear the yellow jersey in the Tour de France, which was a massive deal at the time, victories in some of the biggest classics in the Caper, a couple of Commonwealth Games gold medals, and so, so, so much more. But for me, the real joy in this episode is Phil's ability to tell some incredible stories about a time. Well, sport at that stage wasn't quite so professionally packaged, monitored and scientific. Phil's was a wonderfully outrageous time of pre-race steaks, mid-race Coca-Colas, no helmets, a lot of risk admittedly, long-distance phone calls back home and plenty of fluoro bike gear.
Mystery, what is to be? So much more than meets the eye. Listen to me, time is your key. You will find out by and by.
You will hear in this episode a reference to an advertisement starring Phil in Part B. Whatever you do, at some stage, please Google it. It is all that is good in the world, that ad. And while you're at it, check out a few photos of Phil in the day. He put the S in style. Part B of the episode is where Phil really begins to let loose with some outrageous stories that will make you laugh and shake your head at the same time. Phil has a ripper website, PhilAndersonCycling.com.au, from where you can join him on some amazing cycling tours, including the Vuelta in Spain. You actually ride with Phil on his trips. How good is that? Check it out, PhilAndersonCycling.com.au. Go cycling with Phil.
You can do it if you try, try, try. If you try, try, try.
To put it simply, after being lucky enough to spend a couple of hours with the great man, the best way to describe Phil Anderson is that he is a ripping, ripping bloke. Enjoy Phil Anderson OAM.
So when you search and then you find and know just where to go and thoughts that once used to cloud your mind, you see clearly and now you know mystery, what is to be revealed in King Selassie I. Come on, children, tread with me. We want to reach Mount Zion.
Phil Anderson, welcome to the Howie Games. How are you going?
Yeah, good, good. I feel privileged to be here.
No, you don't want to be privileged. Could just describe the scene for me, because I've just spent an hour and a half in surf, 2 minutes from where you live. I've been surfing at Kennet River. You're a little bit further down. You are living in... Well, you're living in God's country, aren't you?
Yeah, no, it's beautiful here. We're maybe, less than 100 metres from the break, just across the road. And, it's very quiet. It's only about 7 or 8 homes here in this little hamlet where I live. And, like you say, it's God's country. You know, I usually exercise every day, and it's a wonderful place to run or to ride, whether you're riding the road or the gravel at the back or the dirt. So, and running the trails and in the Otways couldn't get much better.
And you look incredibly fit. Like, how old are you, Phil?
Now 60.
60. Yep. I reckon you got a sort of 45-year-old look about you. You got veins sticking out of your arms. So there's nothing on you. Obviously, health and fitness is still a massive part of your life.
Yeah, look, I try and work out every day. Obviously if you're traveling, that's very difficult. If I'm at least 6 days a week, I'm exercising, and it is part of my life. And,
Days when you can't, when you're traveling and you haven't exercised, how do you feel?
I don't know, your metabolism's, buggered up, and, your appetite wanes a little bit, and you feel... guilty about having too many beers at night. And I mean, half the reason why you exercise is for those things, you know, so you can enjoy maybe some of those vices, which, you know, you'd feel really guilty about if you didn't exercise.
And you obviously eat pretty healthily too.
Yeah, yeah. You know, my partner, she's pretty much not a vegetarian, but she doesn't eat much meat. So we eat a lot of legumes, a lot of beans and vegetables. We have a great garden, so we get a lot of vegetables out of the garden. I look after myself.
Well, I was doing one of these podcasts the other day with Liesl Jones, who had not swam more than 5 laps of a 50-metre pool since she retired. This is obviously not the case with you. You still have a love affair with the bike?
Yeah, well, look, when I stopped, that was back in 94, so a few years ago now, you know, the first 12 months I didn't ride much. I was running. I was running more than I am now. But, yeah, after 12 months or so, I started riding a little bit more, started taking more interest in the development of the bike as it's evolved since my racing days. And, now I'm right into it and, you know, follow the trends and marvel at the old bikes that we used to ride and how the hell we got them over those mountains. it's part of my life now. And, I can go without riding, but at least running or, you know, in the gym or whatever. But, I love the exercise.
So where did this all start for you? Tell me a little bit about your family, Phil.
I was actually born in England. Not everybody knows that. They assume I was born in Australia. But when I was very young, I came back to Australia with my mother, who was originally Australian. And, she separated from my genetic father.
Right. He stayed back in England.
And he stayed in England. And came back to Australia with my sister. And we went to Adelaide and we spent a few years there. Where my mother worked and her family was. So, then she remarried and we moved to Melbourne. By then I was maybe 7. From then right through until I left for my racing career, I was in Melbourne. So didn't really get my first bike, although I'd started riding a little bit just with neighbours' bikes, like... My stepfather said that, he wouldn't get me a bike until I'd stopped growing. But, of course, you know, you don't want to hear that when you're a kid because you're growing all the time. So I was just riding around on other, friends' bikes, neighbours and stuff like that, but, you know, just knocking around the neighbourhood. And it wasn't 12 until I got my first bike, which is like a 3-speed, three-speed bike. It wasn't a racing bike by any means.
What colour was it?
Red. It was a red Orencia.
Was it a magical thing for you, the first bike?
It was. I mean, it was, bikes back then were, they were made by a craftsman. They weren't sort of spat out of a factory in some place out of Australia.
Yeah.
They were actually made in Melbourne. By a craftsman and welded up. And
how was the bike delivered? Was it a present or was it at the go to the shop?
It was a Christmas present. My sister got one and I only got one.
Under the tree type job?
Might have been parked in the living room.
Okay.
Might have been parked in the living room. But, I loved that bike and, I dragged my sister all over Melbourne riding her bikes. It's really, gave you an extra freedom to get around and... wasn't until a couple of years later, until I was 15, that I saw a bike race. I'd sort of been riding around quite a bit, but I'd never seen a bike race. And then one afternoon, I was down Kew Boulevard and saw a bike race around the loop up there, which they call, what do they call that now? Anyway, there's a loop which they do. And they still do it there. They still race there. But anyway, I saw a a gentleman on the corner, a marshal with a flag, and I asked him a little bit about this bike racing. You know, I was like a 15-year-old kid. What is this stuff? You know, they're going so fast. You know, do they ever crash? And, you know, I was just asking this guy, and you know, he sort of briefly explained there's a heap of clubs around Melbourne, and, you know, there's the track and the road, and, you know, there's a Hawthorn club, but, you know, go down to the local bike shop and they'll be able to direct you to the right way. So, you know, I think the next day I was down in down Hawthorn.
What was it? What was it when you saw the racing that hit you? That made you want to look down there?
The speed and seeing the lean of the corners, and you know, I'd never seen bike race on TV, or didn't really know it was a sport. So it's 15. Yeah, I might have heard it as a sport because I was at school. You had to do French, and I'm pretty sure our French master might have mentioned the Tour de France. But you know, I didn't really. I possibly wasn't listening.
If only the both of you knew what was to come.
Yeah, exactly. But anyway.
You weren't listening. What were you like in school?
I was easily distracted, and right. You know, I wouldn't say I was a great scholar by any means. You know, I was always like you know, the kid down the end of the road looking out the window,
okay,
thinking of other places to be, and you know, I'd like to be riding my bike somewhere, not necessarily racing, but just the adventure of, you know, going out into the, you know, outer suburbs. And
so the bike was freedom for you.
The bike was freedom and adventure. And you know, I was into endurance sports at school, not so much football, but cross country and swimming and athletics. You know, when it came to football and everybody's choosing, so I was always the last kid to be chosen.
Right.
But they knew I could run, so.
You'd be perfect in the modern game, Phil. You'd be an asset.
You know, yeah. But, so I just, you know, went to the local bike shop. The guy said, yeah, here's the Hawthorn Club, and they have meetings every Monday night or every, you know, fourth Monday of the month or whatever. So I went down to the a club meeting and joined up, you know, without really knowing much about it. You know, by that time I was 16, so I started racing when I was 16. And
what was your first race?
Would have been a road race, like a club race, or maybe a combine, which is, you know, a couple of clubs, maybe Hawthorn and Carnegie and maybe Blackburn. I think it was out at Narre Warren or Narre Warren North. So, I guess it's way out.
Yeah.
It is way out. But, you know, somebody came and picked me up and took us out there. And I think I got last. maybe it was a photo finish for last. No, I didn't really know. You know, like I just, you know, I had to put together a bike, and you know, it was all bits and secondhand bits and pieces, and you know, I didn't have money to go out and spend on a new bike, and you know, but I was good at fiddling around with things, and you know, I put together a bike and went out to the first race, and you know, I had no idea about sitting on, sheltering out of the wind and all this sort of stuff. And I was 16, so I was a junior, but we used to race, you know, that we used to have handicaps, I used to call them. So everybody does the same distance, but you know, the slower, the new riders start earlier. They might start, you know, 15 minutes before the really fast ones, you know, on a 50K circuit or something. So,
and they chase you down.
And they chase you down, yeah. So so that's what happened. They chased me down. And I remember hearing them. I'd never heard a bunch, like, you know, around Kew Boulevard, you know, I was just on a corner and you know, you'd see the riders whip around. But when you're in a bunch or when you're riding and a big bunch comes by, you can hear the tires and stuff like that. And I thought, what the hell is that noise? You know, just like riding along and not, you know, I think I was by myself, you know, because I was the newbie. So I will send the newbie off bloody, you know, 10 minutes before everybody else. And I go, what's that noise? And then, you know, like 50 riders went by and said, ah, that's what it was. By the time I got to the finish, you know, they were packing stuff up. I don't think they even registered me as finishing, you know. You know, they're possibly, you know, driving home going, anybody see when that newbie came in?
Or how he's getting home from Narre Warren.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
So you must have progressed reasonably quickly in that sphere, I guess.
Yeah, well, I did a few races like that where, you know, just handicaps and you just, you know, as a young rider, I didn't really learn very much in those type of events. And then, you know, the club that I was in, the Hawthorn Club, which is a beautiful, great club, you know, there's a bit of a change in the management and the, you know, the new president took me under his arm and said, come on, Phil, we'll sort things out, you know, and just started talking a little bit about training and tactics and, you know, how to ride, where to ride in a bunch and things like that. And, you know, automatically I started improving, you know, and all of a sudden saying, oh, yeah, I get that. So, yeah, you know, I started meeting some friends, you know, making some friends amongst the group you know, learning a lot. I just became a sponge. But I didn't, you know, I didn't know anything about other than this club race. I didn't know there was, you know, maybe I'd heard of the Tour de France, but, you know, I'd heard of the Commonwealth Games because a couple of sons of the president of our club went over to Christchurch. That would have been 74,
right.
74. His two sons went over and did that was on the track, you know, so I'd heard about that, and, you know, like the heroes of the club. So, you know, but for me it was, you know, it was so beyond where I was at this stage. I was just trying to catch that group as they came shooting by.
So so you're 16, 17 at this stage. Yeah. What was life going to involve? What was the plan?
Well, I was at school. I went to Trinity in Melbourne, yep. Trinity Grammar, and you know, I was going to go to university or tech school to do graphic design. You know, that was the path I was going to be taking. The cycling was just a hobby, just a pastime on the weekend, you know. I never, you know, the early times I wasn't training. I'd just pull the bike out at the weekends and race, you know, just getting by on youthful enthusiasm. And, you know, I mean, I was had some athletic ability from, you know, other things I was doing, you know, sport at school. So, but then, you know, under a bit of direction from this new president, Ted Sanders, I, you know, automatically started improving, you know, and eventually did bigger races and bunch races where you're starting a bunch, scratch races they call them. And then eventually I wind up to do a Victorian time trial championship. And time trials where, you know, everybody goes off individually, so there's no bunch to be worried about.
Yep.
Overtaking me. And yeah. I guess it's a little bit like a handicap because everybody goes off at different times. But I think it was like a 40-kilometre time trial. And going out to the race, you know, going with this guy, Ted, he says, Phil, think about, you know, I'd never ridden a time trial before. So think about a time trial, Phil, you really got to concentrate. You know, your mind can't wander. You just got to concentrate. You know, don't worry about how you're going to get home or, you know, don't think about the women or the girls, not women at that stage, only 16 or 17. you know, just concentrate, putting power through the bike, you know, through your legs into the road. And, you know, I remember racing, you know, this time trial and, you know, your mind will start wondering or start, you know, you start thinking about, oh, you know, is that another rider up there? Or, oh, who's that? I think I know that person, you know. And you suddenly say, oh, Ted's words, you know, concentrate and focus and you know, sort of bring you back on. And then I got to the finish of that Victorian Championship time trial. I think it was out at Balan or somewhere. And got to the end of the time trial and I had like, you know, 15 seconds. I was leading by 15 seconds, but, you know, I was the newbie, so I was off one of the first riders. And, you know, so I was in the hot seat. This was before anybody had hot seats, but anyway.
So you're watching the next lot of riders.
Yeah, watching the riders come in and, oh, somebody came in. They came within, you know, 7 seconds and then somebody came in 4 seconds and there's only two riders to go and then finally I'd won by 1 second, you know.
Right. So you're the Victorian
so
champion.
All of a sudden, anything that Ted told me, I was like leaning on every word because, right, you know, I'd come from a, you know, very much a novice club rider into, you know, a Victorian champion. It's only a junior championship, so... But anyway, there's a big step up, you know, and there's little things like that through, you know, those early days where you can sort of see the progression, you know. And then, you know, eventually I got onto the Victorian team and we went to, you know, the national championships at the track, you know, because you do the track as well.
Mm.
And then I don't know.
You went to a Commonwealth Games?
Yeah.
So was
and
that
then I got the Commonwealth Games.
78?
78, yeah.
So what was that?
That was in Edmonton.
Edmonton?
Yeah.
And you won a gold medal there.
You got a gold medal there. Yep. So
in the road race.
Yep. So 200-kilometer road race.
Was that a surprise? Like, where were you going in? If there was was bookies at that stage, would they have been on young Phil or not?
They might have been because I was you know, it was only 4 years. I'd only been riding for 4 years, but, you know, there was certainly a progression from those early days. And, you know, to get onto the Commonwealth Games team, obviously there's a selection process, and I'd sort of done reasonably well to get onto the team. And, you know, I used to hang with these Italians, you know, being a sort of European sport. You know, there was this Italian family, the Sansonettis. They're out, like, Reservoir Way in the Preston Club, and you know, they were heroes of heroes of Australia, I guess, because they won so many Australian championships. I think they were Australian bred, but comes from Italian family. So you know, there was four guys. There was a selection for four riders to go to the Commonwealth Games, and two of them were the Sansonettis. They were twinned, actually, Sal and Remo, and then there was this me, Hawthorne, and then there was Grindel from Queensland. So the four of us went over. It was certainly my first, you know, big trip, and over to Canada. And leading into it, we stopped in America and we did some events there, and I'd done very well racing there, winning a stages. And then when we went to Edmonton, we had a couple of training races leading up to it where most of the riders doing the games were there, and I think I won both of those. And so I think, you know, the bookies would have been on the first page.
Right.
But, I mean, and like in many sports, the Commonwealth Games is not like, it's not even like the Olympics, you know, but it's certainly not like the World Championships. You know, you haven't got many of the European countries there. You know, many of the cycling nations, you know, Belgium, France, Holland, Italy, they're not at, in the Commonwealth Games, obviously.
No.
They'll do the Olympics. But anyway, it was great, you know.
You still got your medal somewhere?
Yeah, I found it the other day, actually.
Right.
Yeah, so, it was great for me. I mean, it was, you know, the Commonwealth Games were pretty big in Australia. I mean, they still are. They're still, you know, highly respected. They don't mean anything on cycling circles.
Was your race back on the telly back here, do you know?
Yeah, it was on the telly. And
who would have been doing the Commonwealth Games then?
I don't know who.
Right.
I think it was Channel 9.
Okay.
But I haven't looked at it, but somebody sent it to me not long ago. Hopefully I kept it. I think I've got, yeah. I've started to digitise a lot of my old VHS tapes.
Okay.
and hopefully I've saved it, otherwise I'll have to search it out again. But yeah, there are copies. It's pretty scratchy. It's black and white.
Right.
Black and white. 70, I don't know when colour came in. Colour was possibly in by then, but I think I remember black and white.
So at that stage, Phil, actually I just want to ask something that goes way back. I'll just ask you, we've only met. You mentioned that your dad, your biological father, was in England.
Yeah.
Did you have any contact with him after you came to Australia or not?
Okay, that's a whole other story.
And is that a story you want to talk about or not?
Yeah, no, that's fine. But if we go forward a few years, it wasn't until I was like number one in the world in 84 or 85, in 85, that there was a magazine, I think it was The Guardian, English paper, came over and they did a, they wanted to do a colour piece, just a story on me, and it was in like the Good Weekend sort of thing, you know, it was a cover story of a sort of weekend pull-out sort of thing about, you know, Phil Anderson. Because every year I used to go to Britain and they used to pick up every year that, you know, I was born there. And so they'd always claim it as their own, okay?
Of course they would.
You know, I went to a Britain a few times, so they'd always claim me. And so anyway, The Guardian picked up on that, and that was and so when this journalist came over to Belgium where I was living and interviewed me, he asked me, you know, sort of kept asking me about my family. And I didn't know anything about my father. I just said, well, you know, my mum and father separated and my mother sort of lost contact. You know, there was very little, you know, there was no contact between my mother and my father. So I didn't even know where he lived. All I said was, you know, I know he's British and, you know, I think he was in the film industry. And so the headlines of the article, or, you know, one of the captions was, Mr. Anderson, if you knew who your son was, you'd be surprised or whatever.
Right.
Okay? Like it was really, they really sort of picked up on that. And then, the editor of the newspaper sent me a copy, you know, the week following, the hard copy of the article, which is really nice. But then there was a letter in there, and the letter was from my father's brother.
Huh.
And the letter said that, you know, just explained that, you know, that if I wanted, he could put me in contact with my father, and told me a little bit about him. He's now living in California and, you know, still in the film industry and, you know, he's sailing the world and all sorts of stuff, you know. And
big decision to make.
Yeah. And I said, yeah, I was bloody curious, you know. This is before email or the internet or anything like that. So everything was like fax or writing letters, you know. So the next time I was in the States, which was a couple of months later, you know, we'd arranged for him to come up and see me. I was in up in Seattle. I was living in Seattle, and he'd come up and you know, we reunited. Well, I was very young when he left, and so.
I
but anyway, it's
what
it's,
was it like? I don't want to pry. Oh, what no, was it, like it was, when you it, first was saw him?
It was strange. I remember calling him, you know, 2 days before, and I said. I haven't even seen any photos of you. How am I going to recognise you when I go to the airport? You know, do I hold a sign saying Mr. Anderson or something?
I'm Mr. Anderson. You're Mr. Anderson.
Yeah. He said, oh, no, you recognise me. I'll be wearing a, you know, a sailing jacket and, you know, got a beard and, you know, look like a real scurvy dog. So,
right.
You know, and he stood out. And we went away and had a fantastic weekend. You know, we didn't go to my place. We went to sort of, I'd rented a cabin up on Puget Sound, which is a very remote area up in the northwest. And, you know, I had my wife with me and a couple of friends. And, yeah, it was great. You know, and we just sort of, but it was, you know, you're meeting somebody that you don't really know. I mean, it's a bit like us meeting, you know.
Yeah.
And so you just sort of
find your way.
Yeah, find your way, and, you know, you just find yourself talking, and, you know, you can't, you know, it was not regretting anything or anything like that, just finding stuff out about each other and, you know, where do you live and what have you been doing, you know, for the last, you know, because I was like 25 at that age.
You know. It doesn't sound like you're talking about it, that there was a great hole in your life or anything to that point.
No, there wasn't. No, I mean, it wasn't something that was missing. You know, my mum and my stepfather and my sister, you know, I felt like we were complete, you know. You know, maybe when I was younger, when I was at school, I had a bit of a complex about it because, you know, my mum took my stepfather's surname. So I'd go introduce, oh, this is my mum. And say, oh, it's not Mrs. Anderson, it's okay. Mrs. Gray, you know. And, you know, as a young kid, it's like, oh, I'm embarrassed. Oh, should I have to do this? And so, but, you know, it was fine, you know. I don't have any, you know, feelings either way about it. And, you know, we keep touch, you know, exchange Christmas cards, you know, and he's been over here. He hasn't been to the new place, but before, you know, the old place we had. But, yeah, so he's been to Australia a couple of times and, you know, I've been sailing with him. You know, I've been over there. So now he lives in Northern Cal. you know, his place burnt down a few years ago in the fires, and he's moved a bit closer to the club, a bit closer to the coast. But yeah, you know, I think my older sister, like she's maybe 63, Jenny, I think she's been affected more by not having a father, or, you know, has a hole, like what you say. Because when she heard that I'd made contact about it, oh, she was so excited. And now she's not in contact with him daily, but and she's been over there, you know, she was over there, she's been over there half a dozen times to, okay, to see him, and he's been over to see her. Maybe because he's a little bit older, so I think she has some memories of him as a child, whereas I can't remember him, you know. So maybe that's, you know, it's a different thing. It's a different meaning for her than it is for me.
We've gone down a bit of a rabbit hole that I didn't expect to be going down. But now that we're down, I just ask you one further question about it, Phil. I read a fascinating article 4, 5, 6 years ago about elite cyclists, and in particular Tour de France elite cyclists, and more in particular those that have won the Tour. And it mentioned a series of names, and they'd grown up, which is different to what you explained to me, they'd all grown up without fathers, whether it was Cadel or Lance. It was a whole series of them.
Yep.
And they'd all talked in this article, and it was them talking about having to prove something and a drive that the other kids didn't have as a result of their family situation and home. It was mm-hmm. I don't think it sounds like it relates to you, but it was a fascinating article about all these men wanted to prove something, and they had that inner desire, and that's what fueled them to do what is such a demanding sport.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you know, maybe that, you know, maybe there's some validity to that. You know, when I look back, yeah, certainly Lance, Cadel, Greg was a, Greg LeMond, another American, he won it 2 or 3 times. He was okay. His parents were fine. But, I mean, you do have to have incredible drive. No, I mean, I didn't win the Tour, but still, I always felt like I had to prove something.
So what was your drive? We'll get to Europe in a minute. We'll get back on the cycling track here. But what was your drive when you were on the bike and you're absolutely cooked? Why would you keep going?
I guess I didn't want to disappoint those people around me, those people that, you know, when you're an amateur, there's no money. But obviously, yep, once you turn pro, you have a totally different outlook to it, because you know, for a start, you're getting paid, so you know, you've got to, I always believe that you have to deliver what you're getting paid for, but also you've got those around you who are supporting, you know, they're getting paid to look after you, so you've got to do the right thing.
So it was you not wanting to disappoint those around
you?
Yeah,
not what don't want to disappoint, but it's a responsibility, you know. So you know, just, you know, I never found motivation a problem.
Back to Phil in a moment. Next up on the Howie Games, on Thursday the 10th of October, we are pumped to be featuring reigning V8 supercar champion and a man who is smashing long-held records this season, Scott McLaughlin. I think it's fair to say this is Scotty as you have never heard him before, a fascinating young man who takes us deep, deep into the dark world of failure and how to overcome it.
What happens then?
I just start crying. I don't know what I was just. It's just like the hardest moment in my life. You know, I worked so hard to get to that point from when I was 6 years old. You know, getting sponsorships and stuff, and then I was in a position, a great team to win, and I had the big boss there, Roger, watching me, and I felt like a failure. I was a loser. it was a lot of emotions. But I sort of pulled it in, because Dad was always hard on me when I was younger. He's like, if you're ever going to cry, you go on the trailer and you don't do it with anyone. You don't show your emotion, because, you know, no one likes a sore loser. He was always strict on me like that. So sort of pulled it all in when I was coming to the pits, but just broke down again when I walked in and basically saw everyone and TJR crying. It was like a grand final defeat for a losing team, you know, in AFL. So, yeah, it was hard. We won the team's championship, which was a very big thing, but everyone wanted to win the driver's championship as well. And, yeah, I've never been – I was so embarrassed.
Embarrassed, that's an unusual word.
Yeah, I was just like – especially when I rocked up to the gala dinner the next night, the awards dinner, like our Brownlow
The next night.
And seeing Jamie with the championship cup and all the highlights literally from the race in Newcastle and literally every highlight, mate. Like there was like four or five highlights and it was all my stuff ups.
The great fella that is Scotty McLaughlin on the next ep of the Howie Games. Alrighty, back to Phil.
So how did you, as a young bloke, because we'll get to some of your achievements and you're a trailblazer in so many ways, which is why it's a real thrill for me to sit down and have a chat with you about it. How did you end up in Europe and would you get off the plane and think, holy hell, what's going on here? Because it was a European sport that you were stepping into then.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's a completely different era than now because now you can flick on the TV and you know, you can watch the Tour de France or you can go online and watch an interview, listen to your interview with Cadell. You know, back then, if I wanted to find out something about bike racing or, you know, what is the sport of bike racing, you'd have to go down to the library. And at the library, you'd have to go and try and find something in the files.
Get on the old microfiche.
The microfiche, you know, and then there'd be some book and, you know, they might have to get it from another library.
Cross-reference it.
Yeah, you know, and it was very difficult to find information. So I didn't really know that, you know, there was such a thing as a career in cycle sport. You know, I just thought it was just like, you know, playing footy or something like that. It was, and, you know, even footy back in the 70s, you know, there was very little money in it. You know, I just saw it as a hobby, like I said. And it wasn't until I got over to Europe and saw some of the races. And, you know, I went to see one of the early season, you know, okay, step back. I got an invitation to join a club in Paris. And so it wasn't a pro club, just an amateur club, just like a suburban club. And it's quite a well-respected club. So got the invitation, arrived in France, yeah, not knowing what to expect.
You just got off the plane?
Just got off the plane. I was expecting somebody to pick me up. There wasn't.
Do you have a bike with you or not?
No.
Right.
No, but the club was going to supply.
There was no one at the airport?
No one at the airport. I had an address and, you know, so I had to take a cab, you know, which cost a fortune. I don't think I'd ever been in a cab before.
So, and it was more francs than you had in your wallet?
Yeah, that's right, exactly. So, you know, and it was freezing cold. It was like the beginning of the year, so it was like February in Paris and, you know, there's snow. I'd never seen snow before.
Wow.
So, I had no idea what to expect. And, you know, we went down to the south of France with the club. I think there's like 15 riders. And, you know, there's myself and Robert Miller. He was a Scotsman.
How was your French?
At that time I was wishing I'd
spent a bit more attention. Trinity.
Yeah. I should have been sitting away from the window, I think. So I struggled. But, you know, I mean, you're surrounded by French people, so you kind of pick it up and you sort of struggle to. It is a struggle, but eventually, you know, you start getting a bit of a. You know, you start picking up the words and, you know, you're always trying to straining yourself to hear, you know, to understand the conversation. But, you know, eventually you do pick it up, you know.
So were you a curiosity to these guys? Were you accepted by them? Were you a threat to them?
Possibly a bit of a novelty, actually. You know, they were very curious about, you know, the faraway place like Australia. Mm. They didn't really know where Australia was. You know, obviously they spoke English. So they used to, because we spoke English, they treated us like English.
Right.
And they call you beefsteak. Hey, beefsteak. And it wasn't just myself. I mean, all the guys, even Lance. I think Lance in his podcast last week, he was imitating his experiences when he was younger going over there, and they used to call him beefsteak. And he's American. He's not English, you know.
But he spoke English.
Yeah. They call him beefsteak. But anyway, it's silly.
So how do you go from there to being you obviously...
So I get over to join a club, and start doing well, start winning races and getting respect from, you know, my club mates, and they start helping me a little bit, and, did very well. They have a series of races, where there's a point, sort of like an aggregate in France, of races all over France, and it's like a point series. And Robert Miller... the Scotsman and I, we got first and second in that, and we weren't obviously French. So, so the two of us by the end of the season, we'd had offers to turn pro. And in that time, we'd actually seen some professional races and thought, shit, this is bloody fantastic, you know, to be able to do this and they want to pay you for it. It's bloody great, you know. But in doing that, though, we'd throw away our... aspirations to do the Olympics, because this was the year was 79. So the following year is 80. So
Moscow.
The following year is going to be Moscow, and so which ended up being a bit of a debacle because of the the boycott.
So to say yes to the pro team, you're saying no to the Olympics.
Yep, that's right.
Wow.
So and I'd sort of gone over there
40
thinking,
years ago, isn't it, that you had to make those decisions.
Yeah, and I. You know, the reason why I went over to France was to get some experience, because after doing the Com Games, the next step, you know, as a loyal amateur would be to the Olympics.
Yeah.
So, but in seeing that, you know, there is, you can actually make a career out of it, which I did, they didn't have any here in Australia, I thought, shit, you know, I might never get this offer again, you know, even if you win the Olympics, but it's such a bloody lottery, the Olympic Games. So, caution of the wind. Both Miller and I both signed for the Peugeot team. And
what was the deal?
The deal's a 2-year deal. I think they offered 3,600 French francs.
Right.
And we pushed a hard bargain, got 4,000 francs a month. So
look at you, it was like Kerry Packer.
So that would be, I think I remember it was about $1,000 a month.
Okay.
And
was that all your Christmases come at once?
Oh, yeah. It was bloody great. You know, plus they give you all the bikes and, that was – back then it was – you know, you could easily live on that.
Where were you living?
I was living in Paris. I had an apartment in Paris, but that was as an amateur. And then obviously shifting pro, I'd found a place I could rent a bit further out from where I was living. And, my girlfriend could move in with me. I think it was just the two of us, yeah. But anyway, after a couple of months living there, we moved up to Belgium.
Found
a lot better.
It's different now when I asked you 5 minutes ago how you were received by your amateur teammates. Now there's money on the table and there's livings to be made and families to be fed. Now you're the boat from the other side of the world, potentially taking these blokes' jobs, I presume. How are you received in that environment?
Again, seen as a novelty on the team, because instead of calling me beefsteak, they would call me kangaroo.
Right. Is this where your famous Skippy nickname came from?
I guess so. My first year when I joined this pro team, I think we had like 18 riders on the team. And the first year... all the riders wanted to do the tour, and they only put 8 riders or 9 riders of that group of 18, so they sort of cut it. And I knew I wouldn't be doing the tour that first year.
So you knew what the tour was at this stage.
Everybody's making such a big deal about it. Then I got to my second year, and I started winning races. You know, just small races, small stage races.
And does that involve a prize? Is there?
Yeah, there's prize money, okay. But it's split amongst the team. So, but by the time normally there's very little prize money's minimal. Even at the Tour de France, if you win the Tour de France, it's minimal.
Okay,
it's ridiculous. Not like the tennis or the golf,
right?
Or even football. So, So anyway, you know, I started winning races, so get to selection time, and they couldn't really leave me out of the team. And so there'd been Australians, there'd been many great Australians, even like Sir Hubert Offerman, back in the late 20s and early 30s. I just finished reading a book there. He actually rode two Tour de Frances, and you know, they go back to the very first Tour de Frances. So, but there hadn't been anybody for any Aussies do it for a number of years, and so it was a.
So you were selected for 981.
981. Yep.
981.
Yeah, it was my first Tour de France, and so it was going to start down the south, down in Nice. They had a prologue, just a short time trial, and then it was going to go in a clockwise direction, heading over to the Pyrenees and up north over the cobbles and down through the Alps and then back to Paris for the finish. So it was going to, you know, kind of do a lap of France.
So before we get to how you performed in that first Tour de France, tell me, in the early 80s, what was the Tour de France? What was involved? What was your day-to-day?
What was the day-to-day in the Tour?
Yeah.
Not that much different than what it is now.
Big crowds,
pretty much the same. Maybe not quite the same size crowds, but they're always... They're always big. They're always right across the road. It was always, you know, uncontrollable. You know, now they had the barriers. Yeah, I'd say the crowds are bigger now.
Right.
Certainly a lot more international spectators. You know, back then it was more the French, you know, the bordering countries, whereas now you get a lot of Aussies, you get a lot of Americans, a lot of Brits.
Maybe you with one of your tour groups, which we'll get to later on.
There we go. People from all over the world. You know, back then you wouldn't, you know, you'd see flags from different areas of France. You know, you'd see the Bretagne from Brittany and, you know, down the south, you know, people from Italy and that. But you'd never see an Australian flag. You'd never see, you know, now you see flags from everywhere, Eastern Bloc or former Eastern Bloc countries and, you know, flags you don't even recognise. You know, Asia. Columbia, it's crazy.
So you get up in the morning, what's Phil having for breakfast in the early 80s preparing for a day on the bike?
Steak.
This is what I want to know, Phil. Steak.
Jeez. So those Frenchies, you should be calling them beef steaks, eh?
So a couple of steaks to get things going in the morning.
Yeah, that's right. Something to get the arteries going.
Right. And then you get transported to the stage and you ride. You know, you obviously ride your guts out and we'll get your performance.
Okay, your steak out.
Yeah. The stage comes to an end late in the arvo, and then what happens? Like, you know, now we're warm down and gels and massage, and what was happening in your day?
There was no ice baths back then. Right. No. So, basically there's always, you know, you have some responsibilities with the press. You know, if you've been doing a reasonably well, you've got to do interviews, you know, press protocol. If you've been, you know, you might have been up on the podium, doping control, that's always been there. Then, back to the hotel, something to eat, massage, you know, dinner. And
more steak or not?
It could have steak, yes. Yeah. There's always flesh in there somewhere.
Right.
There's always numerous. But, yeah, big meals. And that – look, now teams – a lot of the teams have their own chefs, so they have their own food van. You know, they have big staff. I think the teams now have staff of 40 or 50 people, which is huge. You know, we used to have staff of 2-1, which is maybe 18 or 20 staff on top of the riders, but now it's just gone to another level.
And how hard is the Tour de France?
Oh, look, it's very hard, but it's not like you just go from a sedentary life to into the Tour de France. You've been doing other events leading up to it, which prepare you for it. You know, usually we used to, you know, doing both sort of the Giro and the Tour de France was quite a few people used to do that, whereas there's less that do it now. You know, they seem to make a big deal about it now. But, you know, obviously something like that was good preparation. You know, other races like Dauphiné, which go for a week. So, you know, there's events which which prepare you for the Tour de France. Not you're just going from doing one-day races to suddenly doing a 21-day race. But still, the Tour de France is in itself obviously very, very demanding, and
it can be hot, very it tough. Can be snowing, yeah. Yeah. It can
yeah.
be
yeah. It's 3 weeks in the middle of summer, and it always encompasses the two big mountain ranges of the Alps and the Pyrenees, and then sometimes it hits some of the other mountain ranges too. There's some others over in the northeast of France as well, which you have to go through from time to time. So it can be windy, it can be raining.
Where's the joy? Where is the joy? There must be joy.
The joy is when it stops.
Right. Like banging your head against a wall.
Exactly, that's right.
So tell me about your first tour, which was a remarkable tour, and you will always have the title as the first, people say the first Australian, but my understanding is the first non-European to wear the yellow during the race, which is quite an extraordinary thing.
Yeah, no, it was 81, was, like I said, starting in Nice, and already in the prologue, I think it was like an 8-kilometre time trial along the Promenade des Anglais, past the airport, going out towards Antibes, and to it, turned around and come back. And I think even in the prologue, I'd done okay. I think I'd finished, like 20th. I was certainly in the results sheet. I was on the first page. And so then on like day four, we had a team time trial where the team rides together in a time trial against all the other teams. And the Peugeot team, which I was in, we'd come second in that, and we were beaten by the Dutch rally team. And so day five, the following day, was the first mountain day, and I'd never really ridden in the mountains before. I'd been over the Dandenongs.
You were telling me five minutes ago you're prepared for this. Over the Dandenongs.
But, for me, Glenfarry Row was a big hill.
It's not the Dandenongs and outdoor is. I'm not sure we're talking the same postcode here, Phil.
So, I didn't really know what to expect. Everybody's, it's nice. Everybody knows, even though there was, we didn't have the technology back then. We did have these little cards in your pocket, which you took every day. It has the profile of the race, so you know that there's mountains coming up. It's not a secret.
Right, I'm glad looking at the card.
Yeah, so, I hadn't done reconnaissance or anything like that. I certainly wasn't, it's it's usually the riders that, the riders are going to really figure in the race, might spend some time going over parts of the course. But, I was a newbie. A bit like those first races out at Narre Warren.
waiting for the peloton to run you down.
Waiting for the peloton to take off on me. And so we ended day five, mountain day, and I remember, the pace in the bunch was getting faster and faster and faster. I thought, geez, these bloody mountains, where are they? I remember sort of sitting up, taking my hands off the bars, sitting up and looking across everybody's heads, and they're just going like bloody animals. Where the hell are these bloody mountains,
You wanted
and I asked a colleague on the other side of the van and say, what the fuck is going on here? Where's this bloody, where are these mountains? And says, no, you got to stop looking up there. You got to look up in the sky. And I looked up and you could see above the clouds, you could see these mountain peaks. I thought, holy crap. Suddenly, like the hairs on the end of my back were bloody standing on end. I thought, shit, no wonder everybody's... So, I put my head down, my ass up and bloody, joined the stampede. Everybody's like rushing for the bottom of the bloody mountain, Right. So we turned right up this bloody tiny road, and there's like big screech of brakes and everybody's like bloody... smell of rubber. I think it was a smell of shit as well. So we turned that corner and, suddenly it's all single file and, they eased up somewhat. But, and then there are all these gaps opening. I thought, these idiots are bloody leaving all these gaps, and I found myself sort of leapfrogging all these groups. And finally, we got to the top of the first mountain. You know, we had like four mountains this day, and there's only half the field left. So we'd gone from 200 riders down to 100, and then whistling down the other side, down this descent. I'd never been on a bloody mountain descent. I was aroused.
I
love that descent. I never, you know, and I still love descending. I was aroused. That's right.
Now we're getting to what you ride your bike.
Yeah. There we go. You know, I made a real mess of myself. So down that bloody mountain, and then we get to the second mountain, and the same thing happened. You know, riders are getting dropped, and you know, I thought, gee, you know, the whole time I was just trying to, I was sort of overtaking riders because I couldn't really fight at the front, and so I was sort of fighting from the back, and we got to the top of the next mountain, and I looked behind, and once again, you know, we'd cut in half, so only 50 riders left, and down, tearing down a descent, and then we started the next climb. My director comes up in the car, and
it's no radios at this stage.
No radios,
right.
No.
Shit, so he literally drives up beside.
Yeah,
he
drives up beside, and you know, you could recognise every car. Every team had their own, car following them, and they have a klaxon or a, you know, like at the horn of the car. They'd have a special siren each, so I'd say, oh shit, that's my team car, I'll go back. So you drop back a little bit, and the director, and he says, hey Philippe, you know, you're meant to be looking after
Philippe.
You're meant to be looking after Jean René, our team leader. Where is he? And I go, oh shit, yeah, that's right. I look behind him, and I was at the back. I said, oh yeah, where is he? You know, I said, I'll ease up because I'm pretty stuffed up here. I've been trying to keep up with all these guys. I'll take a bit of a break and I'll wait for him. And he said, no, he's two groups back. You stay there, you know. But he was really pissed off. He said, you know, you're meant to stay with him. You come and see me tonight. You know, you didn't follow instructions. I thought, holy shit, you know, I'm in trouble now. And so, you know, so we get to the top of the, the second last climb, and there's only like 20 riders left, you know, and I thought, shit, you know, can't believe I missed bloody Jean René. But I started recognising these guys around me. They were like heroes of mine, you know, guys I had on my posters in my room back in Kew, where
wow.
I was in my bedroom. And I thought, geez, you know, I'm surrounded by, you know, heroes or, you know, real stars of the sport. And, you know, I'd never seen them live, let alone, you know, up close and personal like this. And these guys were like sneezing on me and pissing on each other and say, oh, it's a real eye-opener. But anyway, then we get down the last descent and once again, you know, it was fantastic, you know. And I was getting the hang of it, you know, and we get to the last, you know, it's going to be a mountaintop finish of the ski resort. So we go up this, and these are climbs which are in the race every year, but, you know, for me, I couldn't even pronounce them, let alone, you know what to expect. And there's crowds and in the end, there's a flurry of attacks at the bottom and, you know, one guy got away, Lucien Van Epp, a great, you know, Belgium climber, and he got away. And, you know, the guys look at me and I thought, shit, don't look at me to chase him. You know, I feel like I'm, you know, looking down on myself and I'm not actually there.
Right.
You know, it's just like
a
fantasy. Yeah. So I was just following but in the end there was only two of us left. So, you know, and it was Bernard Hinault, won the tour the year before, and myself.
A legend of the sport.
Yeah, a legend of the sport. You know, he ended up winning five tours. So, you know, for me, I sort of, you know, he'd try and get away. I think he thought maybe I was just somebody from the crowd. I don't know. But, you know, he'd accelerate and I sort of like slowly but surely peg him back and, you know, I'd come up next to him and, you know, I think my jerseys were too big and, you know, my bike was a bit bloody big for me, and I kind of come up next to him, big lanky kid from Australia, you know, and you know, come up next to him and try and, you know, put him not into the barrier, but just try and put a bit of pressure on him that he'd slow down, you know, because it was, you know, he was going pretty hard. I wasn't that comfortable. Well, obviously, the other 195 guys were all shelled off the back,
yeah,
and you know, I had the fear of having to, you know, speak to my director that night about Jean Rene.
Who's 20K back down the road?
Yeah, exactly. So eventually, you know, we got to the top and, you know, he came around the last bend and, you know, and I said, you know, I didn't know. And, oh, we start sprinting now. Okay, we start sprinting and you know, loosened the Belgian guy. He'd won the stage and you know, just pipped me for the line for a second. So I got third. But because the Peugeot team had beaten Hino's team, it gave me the jersey that night.
How do you find out?
How do you find out you got the jersey?
Yeah.
Oh, suddenly, buddy, everybody's slapping you on the back and high-fiving you. And I say, what was that for? But anyway, I'd figured it out pretty bloody quickly. But
it's a massive deal now. What's made of the yellow jersey, the Maillot de Jaune, whatever you want to call it, the rider that has it at that stage?
What does it symbolise?
Well, you know, now, today,
yeah,
you're on every news service around the world.
Yeah.
When you're in the yeah, yellow. What was the significance of the yellow then for you?
Well, I didn't really know what to expect. I wasn't really prepared for it, you know, for me. You know, I knew it was bigger than winning the Peninsula 3-day tour down here. Yes, representing the Hawthorn Club.
Yes.
Hawthorn Club had a bit of yellow in it, you know, jersey. But no, I knew it was going to be. Pretty big. But you know, suddenly there was, you know, a number of Australian press which came over, because it's always around the same time as Wimbledon. You know, it was like the first week, so it's always, you know, early in July. Yeah. And so, you know, a couple of journalists came over. And so that was nice. You know, suddenly you're sort of, you know, shuffled off and you go to the press area and you're being interviewed and then you go up on the stage, they give you a jersey, you know, podium girls. Nowhere near as attractive as what they are now, from my memory, but
been upgraded now.
Upgraded, that's right. You know, and I remember going to they have a television stage set up where they do a live show, a bit like after the game sort of thing. You know, mm-hmm. You still got your bloody jersey on and your clip clop bloody shoes. You know, and you're sitting down there, and you know they. They saw it as a real novelty. You know, it'd been the first time somebody from outside of Europe had ever got the yellow jersey. But for them, it may as well have been having like an alien, like somebody from a Martian come in and take the yellow jersey, because they were asking me, they didn't ask me about, you know, beating Hino for the yellow jersey. They're asking me about Australia, what sports there are there. You know, I couldn't understand everything they were saying, and then suddenly this guy came in with a map of the world, and it was like, you know, like something you might have at school, a sort of a map of the world, and in the middle was France, and France took up like 25% of the globe.
Of course,
okay,
it did.
And in Australia there was down in the southwest corner of this map there was Australia. It looked like tiny. Looked like a tiny Pacific island, and I said I couldn't even recognise the shape of it. But anyway, yeah, that's Australia down there.
So you pointed to it on the map, on the telly.
Yeah, yeah, and it's down there, and it's down there. That's where it came from, Melbourne. I said, oh, you know, they said, oh, it's cycling a big there, and I said, no, it's cricket or football,
So
that was my very first getting the yellow jersey and up on the stage, and it was funny. And the guy that was holding the map, he was like the organizer of the tour. You know, I didn't know it at the time, but the next year, you know, pretty much the same. And I knew everybody. You know, I knew all these guys. They knew me as Skippy, but I knew Levitin. He was the organizer of the Tour de France, and he was actually up on stage and everybody bringing the map out. But so what does it mean? Well, in hindsight, it means everything.
Well,
but I didn't realize it then. You know, like
are seen as a trailblazer.
Yeah,
now.
Exactly. Yeah, but I didn't know that at the time, and I knew, you know, it was Tour de France, but you know, it wasn't. Well, I wasn't even winning the stage. I was, you know, get the jersey.
Did you ring home or anything? Or
No, I don't think I rang home.
Right.
I think maybe a telegram. I think I might have even got a telegram from Prime Minister. I can't even remember.
Right.
So, yeah, there was some communication, but I don't think it was phone calls. Phone calls from the press, maybe. You know, like phone and everything back then was really expensive. And, you know, I wasn't making huge money. Like most people are getting yellow jersey these days are making $1 million minimum.
Right. Wasn't
even
the case.
Even before they get the jersey.
But wasn't the case.
No, I was still on my 4,000
right.
French francs. So less than $1,000 a month.
And I reckon that I'm not massive historian, especially with cycling, but did you get the white jersey there for the best
young rider?
Yep. And then next year, was it the next year you backed it up where you had 9 days in a row in the yellow?
Yeah. So I got the yellow jersey up there on Plata Tay, which is a ski resort. Actually had a stage finish there this year, and Quintana won the stage, like it was in this last week. So Quintana won this year. And
On the same stage.
The same stage, yeah. But so anyway, the stage after I got the yellow jersey, so you get the yellow jersey on the stage and then the next day you're wearing the jersey. So next day is a time trial, similar to the time trial I had 3 or 4 days ago,
mm-hmm.
The very last, it was penultimate stage this year, down there in the southwest near Po. And anyway, they always talk about the power and the strength that the yellow jersey gives you, okay? Like, I was okay, rider, obviously. I was on the team to do the Tour de France, and in the prologue, I'd finished, you know, I said 20th in the time trial, okay. But anyway, I backed it up on 2 days, so the next day in the time trial, I got third in my first time trial in the Tour de France. It was pretty good. I mean, I'd done
wow.
I keep talking about the Peninsula 3-day tour.
Yeah.
I'd won the time trial there, so I was very experienced. But, you know, to think, let's see, who got third the other day? Froome got second. But, you know, to come out of nowhere. But they say the power the yellow jersey gives you, though, you know, is the responsibility and what it represents, even though I didn't understand, you know, the significance of it. You know, I thought I'd rode pretty well to get third in a time trial on my first Tour de France.
That's the end of part A of Phil Anderson. Please tune in to part B as the crazy stories really begin to flow. See you there.
And we can do it if we try. If we try. If we try.
Listener.